And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here on this Thanksgiving Eve, 2018, Wednesday, November the 21st, 14 minutes past the hour. And this hour, we're going to have some fun as we get ready for the big holiday. We're going to play an interview. Roy Clark was a true gentleman to me in an interview we did about 10 years ago. That I'm going to play in its entirety today. It's about a half hour long, but never been heard on this station before. My interview with Roy Clark in memory as he passed away last Friday, I believe it was, at the age of 85. Thursday. And if we have time, we're going to play the Phyllis Diller Butterball skit. So many people have wanted to hear it again. We played it once. We played it on Monday, but we'll play it again for you in honor of Thanksgiving. But before we do that, here's the interview, never heard before on this station, with the legendary, the late, Roy Clark.
This is Scott Spears, and today we're joined by one of the truly great musicians, actors, and television personalities of the last 100 years. Ooh. A true Renaissance man, in every sense of the word, Roy Clark. Roy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Scott, it's a pleasure to be here, but I don't deserve all those credits, especially the one about the 100 years.
Well, you haven't been around 100 years, but you're one of the greatest in the last 100 years.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much.
Roy, we're sitting on your tour bus right now. Now, do you prefer to travel by bus rather than plane?
Well, I've done both. The only thing is that it's quite expensive, especially these days, to go by plane. I couldn't go commercial. That'd be too much of a hassle. But I had my own airplane and flew for about 30 years. And that really spoiled me.
What are some of the amenities that you have on the tour bus here that are special for you?
Well, my instruments are right at hand. My stage clothes are right at hand. My lounge clothes are just easy to get to. So the convenience of it, it's the second best thing to just staying at home. You know, I go for different rooms at the house to get different things that I want. Whereas on the bus, I can more or less say, okay, we're going to go here, we're going to go there. So I need these clothes for there, these clothes for there. But as wise as I sound now describing it, I'm no better now packing than I was the first day that I did. So it... But a bus is probably the best, taking everything into consideration, the best way to go. It sure beats riding in a station wagon, pulling a little one-wheel trailer, which I have done and did for years. My wife drove while I slept, and then I would perform, and she would sleep, and we would go out together. Looking back on its fond memories, but it was, wouldn't want to do it again.
Roy, anytime I sit down with a musician, and certainly a musician of your caliber, I always have to ask this question. When did you know you were able to sing? When did you know you were able to play an instrument? Because I have no musical ability at all, so I'm always amazed by that.
Well, I really don't know, Scott. I guess it was the first time that I sang in front of a bunch of people and they didn't walk out. I thought maybe I could make a living at it. But my dad played music and his brothers, so I was around music from the time that I was in a crib. And it's just has always been inside of me. But I've always played just for the music and not for the monetary rewards that may follow. You know, that's a whole different ball game. You have to play music for music and enjoy it if you get made. And if you can make a living at it, that's all well and good too. But it never gets better than sitting on the front porch with your family and just playing.
Is that true?
It is very true.
Why is that?
It's because that is what music is. Music is all the cliches you've ever heard. the sound that soothes the savage beast, the universal language known all over the world. And it's true. And it bridges gaps, too, between people. It makes people that enjoy music accept each other a little easier. You know, if you play music, like when we went to the Soviet Union, most of them didn't understand English, but they understood the music. And it really did dawn on me that if it wasn't for music, I don't know what I would be doing.
Roy, when you're sitting on the front porch, what are you singing?
I'm not really singing as much as I'm hearing. I'm hearing just the beauty of a single note on a nice instrument, a guitar, a mandolin, a fiddle, or banjo, or, you know, and it just, when you strike the chord, it doesn't stop at the head. It goes through your entire body, you know. And to see sitting around with your grandparents and your parents and your brothers and sisters and neighbors and stuff, to see them want to sit there and listen to you play, it just doesn't get any better than that.
Do you have a favorite song?
Do I have a favorite song? As long as I've been doing this, Scott, I have so many favorite songs. But I would have to say, for a lot of reasons, and not just the message of the song, but yesterday when I was young, looking back on it, all of the things that are written in the song are things that almost all of us can look back to whatever degree and say, yeah, I could have done that better. I shouldn't have done that. Now, that was pretty nice. I'm glad I did that. But the song tells so much. You know, just to... it was an honor for me to play yesterday when I was young at Mickey Mantle's funeral, or his celebration of life. And that was because of a long-standing friendship. You know, he told me, he said, I want you to sing that at my funeral. And I looked him in the eye and said, what makes you think I'm going to be here? You know, I may go before you. But he saw in that song, especially, you know, the life that he confessed to living, that, you know, he came on with a television special just to talk to young people and say, don't look up to me as an idol and don't live the way that I live. He realized, you know, that he had messed up a lot of chances. But so that song, it goes that deep with me.
I can see by the emotion on your face, of course, we're on radio, that it really hits home with you.
Well, it does. Of course, I did it for Mickey's celebration of life. I'm not eliminating that it goes up. It's a personal song also, you know, the things that I did I'm not proud of. But all in all, if I weigh it or count it percentage wise, I think I'm on the good side.
I think a lot of people would agree. Roy, Dean Martin had his martini, Bob Hope had his golf club. A lot of people associate Roy Clark with the banjo. What's it about the banjo that has allowed you to make that so popular and such an icon with you?
Well, I think it starts to... I'm not playing a whole lot of banjo now because of a tendon that the last time we recorded an album, Buck Trent and I did, we were like 2 weeks in steady rehearsing from sun up to sundown, and then recording for over, this is like 15, 16 days. And I blew a tendon in my thumb, which is a very important part of playing a banjo, that I've had to slack up and let it heal. It's slowly coming back. But a banjo, I think, Steve Martin said, you know, as he was playing his banjo, he says, you know, banjo is a happy instrument. You cannot be unhappy playing a banjo. And a banjo is a happy sound. It's just loud. It grabs your attention. It doesn't, you can't ignore it because of the sheer volume of it. But it's also an American instrument, you know, that born and bred here, the five-string banjo. And I think it's just America's instrument. It should be certified that way.
Roy, I was reading this on the internet this morning, and I wanted to ask you if it was true, because a lot of things are not. You were appearing, it said, on Jimmy Dean's talk show in Washington, D.C., and Jimmy let you go because he said you were not showing up on time, and the quote was, "You're the most talented person I've ever fired," said Jimmy Dean. Is that true?
That's almost verbatim. I was a part of his band, the Texas Wildcats, and Jimmy, I didn't really know just how serious he was when he said to be there at 8 o'clock. I just thought if you were there at 8:05, 8:10, that was close enough to it. And he put up, bless his heart, he put up with me a long time. And finally, we had an early morning, I say an early morning, a warehouse show to play, a warehouse of where people could come in and browse around and look at refrigerators and dryers and all kind of appliances and things. Well, we were hired, or Jimmy was hired, to bring people in. So we did our shows, and it was a Sunday morning. And I came in, I had been out late, and I came in probably 10, 15 minutes late. And Jimmy looked down and said, because I try to sneak around behind the stage, a makeshift stage, and he said, "Don't bother to take it out of the case, Clark." I said, "Oh, come on, Jimmy." I said, "Let me play a couple tunes. You may like them." And he didn't say anything. And I went ahead and took it out. And he said, "It's not doing you any good." So finally, I took the hint. And I left. And I went. We never had a harsh word. Never had any disagreements as such, other than the fact that he was very, very serious about being on time. And one day, leaving the TV station, we were walking down the sidewalk, he and I together, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "Call me Clark." He said, "Clark, you're the most talented guy I've ever been around." He said, "You're going to be a big star someday, but right now I can't afford you." And that's when he told others, he said, that I was the most talented person he ever fired. But like I say, only he put up with it for a long time.
That's a great story. I don't know how many people know that. That's a wonderful story. You were the first country musician to guest host the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. What was that like?
Now see, that goes back to Jimmy Dean, because Jimmy Dean was hosting the Tonight Show in between Jack Parr and Johnny Carson. There was a 6 week or maybe 3 months of guest host in there, trying to break that image of Parr, because Jack Parr was so strong. It would be unfair to bring somebody in, say, on a Monday after Parr had just closed on the previous Friday night. So they broke it up with different people, and Jimmy Dean was one of them. He found me playing a club in Safford, Arizona. And the phone rang, and he said, "Roy, Jimmy." I said, "Hey, what are you doing?" He said, "I've been trying to get in touch with you." He said, I have been guest hosting the Tonight Show, and this was on a Thursday. And he said, and I've been trying to get you because I want to put you on it. And but I can't, I've had a hard time getting a hold of you. So he said, can you make it? I said, I'll get there some way. So Thursday night, someone from Safford in a private airplane flew me to Tucson, where I got on a commercial flight. I got on an airplane in Tucson, flew to Phoenix, got on another commercial flight, went to Chicago, changed planes, went to New York, got there just in time to go right to the NBC studios. And that was about 3 o'clock on Friday, after flying all night long. I didn't see Jimmy till just a little bit before the taping, because it was, I think the taping was like 5 o'clock. So he came out. Now, first of all, he had done enough for me, just wanting to put me on. But he came out and he said, hey, we greeted each other. And he said, what do they have you down for? He said, I told him, I said, well, they said maybe for me to do two tunes, two whatever, and then maybe one with you. Something like we used to do back in Washington when we were doing local television. And he said, well, we'll do the two that they have you down for. And he said, then we'll do two more. And if that don't get them, we'll do two more. He said, when you leave here tonight, you're going to be tall hog at the trough. And so, again, that tells you what Jimmy Dean was all about. You know, then I had to turn right around and get on and just reverse my flight. I went from New York to Chicago, Phoenix, Tucson. When we got to the club where I had been playing, about 7 miles out of town, there was the traffic jam. And no one understood what that was, because someone had picked me up in Tucson in a car and drove me back to Safford. And that appearance on the Tonight Show, it just shows you just the impact of television. We've been having good crowds, but we come in after one appearance on the Tonight Show and like a 7 or 8 mile traffic jam backed up. We had to do like 4 shows a night. You know, had to cut them short, but there was that many people that had paid to get in to see the show.
You did so many great television spots after that on the Beverly Hillbillies, guest spots on other people's variety shows, but I think our audience would be remiss if I didn't mention this show, Hee Haw. Of course. How did Hee Haw come about?
I was a guest on the Jonathan Winters show, and the producers of his show, John Ellsworth and Frank Pepiot, come to me out in the hall at the studio where Jonathan Winters was doing his show, and said they had an idea for a show, and it would be not unlike Laugh-In, a lot of comedy and then music, and would I be interested? Well, you know that you say yes to everything in our business, because a lot of it never comes to pass anyway. So I said, sure. Now, this was like in about September of 1968. And so I think it was in January, my manager called and said, they're ready to go with that show. I said, they're ready to go with what show? He said, well, they're calling it Hee Haw. I said, they're calling what Hee Haw? He said, well, that's just a working title. By the time that it goes on the air, they'll come up with a more suitable title for the show. And then we were supposed to have been a 1-hour special, on CBS just to see what the reaction would be. That was the year that the Smothers Brothers and CBS had a falling out. Well, that left CBS with a summer fill-in, and we were the first choice. So they put us on, and the rest is history, because we were put on the first show that failed, because they had no room for us. You know, we were a hit show, but no room to put it on the air come the regular television season. So they put us as the first alternate. And we went on in June of 1969, and the rest is history.
25-year run on that great show. I don't know if people remember that it went on that long, but it went on until 92, was it?
Well, 92, but it was actually on longer than that. We were in production for 25 years, but then they did some little playing around with it. We did a series called Hee Haw Silver, where I went back in by myself and reintroduced some of the highlights from previous shows. Well, that went for two seasons. And then there was something else they did. So if you put it all together, we were on probably firsthand, we were on about 28 years.
That's an amazing run in television.
It is.
So many brilliant people on that show. Grandpa Jones, Buck Owens, Minnie Pearl, a great cast. Is there some memory that sticks out from Hee Haw?
Lord, we don't have time for that, Scott. Well, to go in on Hee Haw was like a family reunion of people that I had worked with before. Some I had never seen and had never worked with. But Grandpa Jones was the first star that I ever worked with. And that's when I was like 15 years old. I went out on a mini tour. He needed somebody to play guitar and maybe sing a couple songs. And so that was, he was the first one I worked with. So when we all gathered in the studio for the first taping of Hee Haw, I just looked around and here's all my heroes and some strange faces that I'd learned later. You know, they were all very talented people. And they all became family too. But when I saw Grandpa and String Bean and a couple more, the Archie Campbell, you know, that made me feel comfortable. I said, something is right, or they wouldn't be here.
Near 30-year run, was it hard to walk away, or were you ready to leave when it was over?
I don't know if we really believed that it would be over, and it sort of melted away. There was no big office party, it's been fun, but it's over, and we'll never see each other again. It was like in your mindset that although that we're not going to be here on a regular date, we will be working together, and we will be seeing each other, and there really won't be an end to what we've been going through.
You tour a lot now. We talked on the phone yesterday. You said you don't tour as much as you used to, but you still tour an awful lot. When you walk out on the live stage, how long does the audience give you just because you're Roy Clark before they say, okay, let's get down to business?
Bless their hearts. Usually they do. They let me know. In fact, even before I do anything, a lot of times I'll hear someone in the audience say, I'm a picking, you know. Then I'm obligated to say, well, I'm a grinning. And it's a funny thing that they didn't believe, the networks didn't believe that Hee Haw appealed to people up north. They figured it was just all southern people. Nothing happened west of the Hudson. And But we proved him wrong, because people, first of all, hee-haw, the reason it lasted so long, we didn't hurt anyone. We had no political messages. We weren't trying to sell anything. We were just being corny. And what saved us was, on top of the corn, was good music. About the time you'd sit there and go, oh no, then bam, here's a... And all of the big stars today got their first national exposure on Hee Haw.
Roy, you know, you on Hee Haw, you showcase so well how funny you are as an actor.
Looks ain't everything.
Are you an actor who sings, or a singer who acts, or a musician? How would you define Roy Clark?
Well, that's Scott, that is almost impossible to put me in a category, because I'm the world's biggest fan. I love everything. From stage plays on Broadway. In fact, we did a Broadway play. We did Paint Your Wagon with a couple of the cast from Hee Haw, Ganella Hutton and George Lindsay. And that felt very comfortable doing that. But I love to see people laugh. And I found out they don't have to laugh out loud. Just a broad smile is good. And it's enough. You've caused someone for that moment to forget their pains and forget their worries. Because if you laugh, that's an involuntary gesture that you do. I mean, you can't stop it, and you can't, you just enjoy a good, as they say, a good belly laugh. And it, so what I do whatever that moment calls for. I start playing music, but I can tell from the audience the way they react, if what kind of a mood they're in. I almost look at them as a one. All of them, all of the audience make a one. Meaning that if I can get them involved in what I'm doing, then we form a union together. You know, I'm up there with a bright light on me. Sometimes I don't want to be there. I'd rather share it with someone else. But I can see by the looks on their faces, you know, that's no star up there. That's no big deal. That's Roy. And that's good. You know, when they come up to you on the street and start talking, I've had people start talking to me on the street and all of a sudden stopping and apologize and say, I'm sorry. I'm taking all your time. I just felt like I knew you, and you can't buy that. They wouldn't walk up to Frank Sinatra and put their arm around his shoulder and tell him that how much they enjoyed him, but they will Roy.
I think you're right. And just sitting here, and we're doing this interview in person, I'll let the radio audience know, you are a very personable man, and I want to say this because it's radio also, before I ask the last question. I've sat next to a lot of celebrities who, after you see them on television, when you see them in person, you wonder how much makeup was on them when you sat next to them. Roy Clark looks like $1 million. I'm sitting a foot from him. You look great.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. I think I get my genes from my mother, my mother's side.
The final question would be, Roy, I wanted to preface it with that to say, 50 years from now, because you are still going strong, what's the epitaph going to read on Roy Clark?
Whoa, the epitaph on Roy Clark. I don't know. I have several things. Maybe put all of them on there. One of them would be, he tried. And I don't know. That's an awful, awful in-depth question. I can see it, and I can feel it, but but it's hard for me to put it in a capsule.
Roy, I want to leave the audience with this, and I don't want to put you on the spot here. So if you want, don't want to, say you don't want to, but do you want to leave us with a line from your favorite song?
Oh, boy. A line from my favorite song. I don't know. I think I'll just go the other way, Scott, and say the line from my favorite song is, "Thank God and Greyhound, she's gone."
Perfect. Sitting, talking with the legendary, the amazing, what a talent, what a gentleman you are, Roy Clark.
Roy Clark, he certainly was one of a kind. That interview was done about 10 years ago, and what can you say? He was just as nice as he sounded. The legendary Roy Clark, dead at the age of 85 last Thursday. Now, every year, we do the Phyllis Diller Butterball skit. We did it once this year, and somebody said, you gotta do it again. So, by popular request, here's our annual tradition on Thanksgiving, the Phyllis Diller Butterball skit.
Hope you enjoy. This is Scott Spears, and with Thanksgiving just around the corner, I have many questions from listeners about how to make the perfect turkey. So with that in mind, I'm going to call the Butterball Turkey Hotline on air today to speak with a culinary expert to get your turkey troubles answered by a professional. Let's dial the old Butterball Hotline here and see if we can get somebody on the line. I'm sure they get a lot of calls this time of year, but very eager to answer, I'm sure. Good people over at Butterball. Not sure how long this hotline's been up and running, but I know it's been a while.
Butterball here.
Yes, this is Scott Spears from W...
Oh, yeah, Scott. I recognize your voice, Scott. I'm Butterball.
Now, wait. This voice sounds familiar.
Oh, my voice?
Your voice.
I'm the voice of Butterball.
You're the voice of Butterball.
Yeah, you better believe it.
Now, wait a second. This sounds like Phyllis Diller, not a Butterball employee.
You got it.
What are you doing working for Butterball, Phyllis?
Well, I always need to pick up a little extra change, and I wouldn't mind a little slice of something to eat that's that good.
Are you versed in turkey etiquette?
Well, they hired me, didn't they?
Yeah, okay. Well, I've got some questions for you, Phyllis.
I bet you do. I bet you got a lot of questions. I got the answers.
Okay, well, here we go. Let's get to the questions that the listeners have submitted. How do you thaw a frozen turkey on Thanksgiving Day? Does the size of the roasting pan make a difference? That's from Jessica from Cardington.
Now, that's about four different questions. Will you slow down, Scott?
I will. Let me try that again.
Try one question at a time.
I will try to take them in
order.
That's a good one. How do you thaw a frozen turkey on Thanksgiving Day?
Okay, that is the dumbest question I've ever heard. And number one, a turkey doesn't thaw on the day that you're going to eat it. Because that damn thing is hard as a rock. You got to leave it out overnight. And the poor thing is frozen in the first place. Be sure you cover it with a quilt so it doesn't cry. Because if it cries, it'll keep you awake all night. Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
They have feathers, but they're cold.
You know, Phyllis, so you're telling me if you haven't put your turkey out the night before...
No, you don't cook it the night before.
No.
You thaw it out all night. Sometimes it takes two nights to thaw out Fang. Coldest man I ever knew.
How's he doing?
Terrible.
Really? Does he like the holidays?
I make him sleep with a turkey.
Phyllis, second part of this question. Does the size of the roasting pan make a difference?
Oh, boy. It makes the turkey crazy to see that roasting pan. I'll tell you the difference it makes. I have a big roasting pan that the turkey fits in, but you can't shut the oven door.
So what
it's
do you...
It's too big to go in the oven.
What do you do?
Well, I go next door and borrow a pan.
So you kind of lean on your neighbors at the holidays.
What about the neighbors?
You lean on your neighbors at the holiday time.
Lean? They're my whole life.
Hey, there you go. Let's get on to question. Are you busy this year, at this time of year, by the way, Phyllis, with Butterball?
I'm busy every time of year. Yep. People love my Butterball. I have explained to people year after year, day after day, turkey is not used as a meat often enough. It is a healthful meat. It is one of the cheapest meats you can serve, and yet the idiots only do it once a year. Have I made it clear?
You've made it clear, Phyllis. Question number two. What internal temperature should the turkey be when it's done? That's from Betty and Marion.
Oh, Betty and Marion. Is that two women or a man and a woman?
I believe that's one person here in Marion, Ohio.
Oh, Betty in Marion.
Yes.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Well, the internal temperature should always be 68 degrees. Every room in the house should be 68 degrees.
So the turkey should be the same temperature.
I didn't say that. You said what should the internal temperature be, and you mean of the turkey?
Of the turkey.
Well, hell, I've never been in a turkey. I don't know about that.
Does Butterball?
How would I know? I can't get in there.
Does Butterball give you any type of training, Phyllis?
No, they assumed that I knew. Oh, that'll be the day.
Well, I think that last one's a lost cause. Let's go on to number three.
Oh, yeah.
How should I carve the Thanksgiving turkey? That's from Joan, who is also in Marion.
Joan lives in Marion. Well, it's a lovely little town. Lovely little town. When you carve a turkey, you should use a knife.
Does Fang carve your turkey?
You think I would let him have a knife?
Have there been problems in the past with that?
Oh, he's too dangerous to let him have a knife. He'd probably cut the curtains down, and he'd probably do a lot of damage, and he's not trustworthy.
Is there any special way to carve the turkey? Of course you do it with a knife, but is there any special carving method?
Let me think. Well, I would start with the juiciest, biggest, meatiest part of the turkey poo, and that would be the breast. The breast of your Butterball. A Butterball breast, you can't beat that food. Then you get that dressing, that gravy, and I'm starting to drool.
You're making me hungry, Phyllis.
Oh, goody.
Here we go. Question number four. What kind of stuffing should I use? This comes from Brandon in Cardington.
Where's Cardington?
Cardington's just up the road from Marion, about 15 minutes.
Is that one of those chic suburbs?
Well, I don't know how chic it is. I don't want to offend the people in Cardington, but it's not bad.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a little other community close to Marion.
A little piece of heaven.
Is that what it is?
I that's how I like to put it.
That's what a Butterball is, a little piece of heaven. Well, I forgot the question.
Stuffing, Phyllis.
Oh, stuffing. Oh, guess what? My favorite part of the whole din-din is the stuffing. God, and there are at least 100 different varieties. A lot of people use cornbread. I prefer stale bread, which I have amassed during the year.
Stale bread?
Stale bread, yes. I'll take all the stale bread, cut it up in little croutons, and I prefer old-fashioned country dressing. Simply celery, and that stale bread all cut up, as celery salt, garlic salt, onions all cut up, lots of garlic, fresh garlic all cut up, and let's see what else we put in. Onions, celery, and bread are the basics. From then on, you go with all the different spices. I know that for a fact, for my Thanksgiving dinner, I'm going to be a guest at Rosemary Stack's home. That's Robert Stack's widow.
Really?
Yeah, and she has a cook who makes something I never heard of. She mentioned one of the spices. I can't remember now, but it was a spice I never heard of in a stuffing. So I can't wait to go there. So just sit at a lavish, they used to call it board.
Phil,
know, lavish table, and eat somebody else's cooking.
Phyllis, did you know Robert Stack well?
Oh, yes, but I never slept with him. I didn't know him that well. But his wife, his widow, is a close friend, and I loved Robert Stack. He was an adorable man.
You know, Phyllis, he was a great actor. He seemed like a nice guy when you would see him on television, but because of that show, Unsolved Mysteries, he gave me nightmares.
Really?
He did. I just, every time I heard his voice,
I was
taken back.
Well, you know, he worked till he died. He was over 80, and he loved his work, and he always wanted to work. And I thought that was a good thing. I think it was sage, the dressing. Sage?
Oh, that, yeah.
Would that be maybe one?
Well, that's a good spice.
Well, I maybe it's a sage turkey dressing.
A sage turkey dressing from a sage woman for a sage turkey.
Hot. Damn.
There we go. One more question, Phyllis, and then we'll let you get back to the phones there at Butterball. How long should I cook a 10-pound turkey? That comes from James, who's also here in Marion.
Jane.
Whatever, at this point, it doesn't really matter.
All right. Okay, you should cook it till it's done.
That's kind of vague, Phyllis.
Well, it must be tender through. I'm no good with those thermometers and the ice pick and the this and that. I don't know. Take a fork.
Jam a fork in it.
Yeah, do that.
And if it doesn't yell, ouch, you're okay.
Sort of.
Well, Phyllis, you're going over to the Stacks for Thanksgiving. Mrs. Stack.
Yes.
Should be a lot of fun.
Oh, yes.
And the Butterball people aren't keeping you too busy?
No, they're very good to me. They love my rum balls.
Do they?
Oh, yeah. I make rum balls for the children every Thanksgiving.
And how does that go?
Well, one Thanksgiving I got a little confused because I was drinking a lot of rum while I was making them. And I got confused with the recipe. Got far too much rum in my rum balls. And all these happy children running around full of rum. It wore off.
Phyllis Diller, you're a treasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Thanksgiving and giving us something to laugh about. And you know, laughter behind turkey is the best medicine.
Absolutely. Eat well, laugh well, live well.
Absolutely. The wonderful, gracious, my pal, the amazing Phyllis Diller. Happy Thanksgiving.
And my pal, Scott Spears. You have one, too.
The Phyllis Diller Butterball sketch, something we always love to do every year. What a treasure Phyllis Diller was. We will knee open tomorrow, but we hope you listen. We've got some new programming headed your way, and we hope you have the most amazing Thanksgiving holiday no matter where you are tomorrow. If you go to a church, or if you celebrate with your family, or Maybe you do something at home, like I'm going to undertake. I hope you enjoyed the program today. I hope you stay tuned. Much more programming coming up here on WWGH Radio. It never goes away. We're going to be live all over the place, so don't tune that dial. You never know when we're going to pop up. But for all the show hosts and the guests and the managers here at WWGH Radio, we certainly wish you and yours a very happy Thanksgiving holiday. Enjoy the parade. Enjoy your family. Enjoy the food. And we'll be back very soon. For this Thanksgiving Eve, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
We're on 10 to 12 today, and welcome your phone calls. Today, I'm going to leave it up